Boy, howdy. Welcome to the Deep Fried Bites podcast show. Are you ready for some gumpology? Well, Mr. Woody, welcome back to the show, buddy. How are you?
Good. How about you, man? I'm really excited about this second show.
You know what? It's going to be a great show, I think. We've got a kind of a unique show lined up for this one. We're going to be talking about something that happened about a month ago, but it's still very relative to today's, you know, standards and needs and concerns of developers out there, I think. So
I know it is. I have listened to it, and I think it's something that people need to hear and learn from.
Yeah, I think so. I think everybody can kind of learn some stuff from this. I mean, I learned some things sitting there on site with the guys. Here's the story, gang. Here's what happened. Back in April, about 1,700 Microsoft Most Valued Professionals, which are referred to as those that have been awarded with an MVP award, went to Seattle, Washington. And it's what's known as the MVP Summit. And about 11 o'clock on April 13th on a Sunday, a whole slew of us got together at the hotel lobby of the Westin. And we got to talking about stuff, and somebody said, you know what? We should record this. And I jumped up and I said, hey, I've got a recording device. I'll record it. We'll do a podcast out of it. And so I jumped up, Woody, and went to the room, grabbed my recording device, and came back down. And basically what happened was there was a whole bunch of people sitting in the lobby of the hotel, and they were all, for the most part, everybody was an MVP there. There were a couple of people that were local to Seattle that were hanging out with us, like Jeff Tucker, for example. And we said, look, what can we record and tell somebody about? And so we decided that the best thing to do is talk about interviewing, which is pretty interesting because everybody's interviewed, right?
Sure, everyone has.
Yeah, everybody's gone through an interview process at some point or another. And there are a lot of interesting stories that come out of interviews. I mean, I could probably do a whole hour show on this just by myself. But what I wanted to do was kind of capture a bunch of interview war stories. And so what we did was we put the microphone. Well, actually, back up, we had two microphones there. And what we did was we had about 11 or 12 guys, and the actual audience grew up as we started discussing stuff. And we passed a microphone around to everybody that was in the group, let them introduce themselves, and we just started talking. And you can kind of get a feel for, as the show went along, everybody started to loosen up and have fun and just kind of go with it. So it's a very unique show. But let me put a couple of caveats out there for everybody, okay? Remember that this show was recorded live in a lobby of a hotel, okay? So you're going to hear some background noise. You're going to hear some people talking and chatter going on and those things. That's okay. For the most part, you're going to hear that everything is really, really clear and the high-quality audio that we like to do on Deep Fried Bites. But remember that this is recorded live, and there's been very little editing that's actually gone on with this particular audio. So keep that in mind as you listen to it, and some of the really interesting things actually occur in the background. So turn your speakers up or your headphones up and listen to those little nuances going on in the background, because there's some really good gems there, and you can actually hear what the other guys are saying in the background sometime, and then that leads to other conversations.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I was there. I mean, I've met most of those guys, and I follow the rest of them on Twitter and their blogs. Man, I wish I was there. But it felt like I was there listening to the kind of the conversation that was going on. So I think everyone's going to get a lot out of this. And like you said, turn it up, and you can hear other people make some side comments, kind of go off on tangents. And this is the fly on the wall. I mean, you literally know what people are thinking. You're getting that MVP expert guru thoughts from all their experience. So this is really valuable, I think.
Again, this was recorded in April 13th back at the MVP Summit. So, Woody, you ready?
I'm ready, man. Let's do it.
Let's go to Seattle, folks. MVP Summit in Seattle. Here we go. today at the Westin Lobby. So what we're going to do is we're going to start out, we're going to go around the table, and we're going to introduce ourselves, and then we're going to just start telling some stories, and we'll kind of see how this goes. So let's start to my left.
My name is Rob Connery.
I work at Microsoft during the day. Right now I'm kind of just having some beers with some friends, and I work on Subsonic, and that's what I do.
So Scott is not taking the mic, but we're going to force him to anyway. So
I'm Scott Wittermassick. I work for Telligent.
All right, so next to him we have...
My name is Steve Harmon. I work for Quick Solutions, but I also work for the Subtext project. I worked a little bit with on the Structure Map project, a little bit with Rob on Subsonic, and Oren, big fan of Rhino Mox, and basically everything that Oren puts out over there. So,
my name is Jeff Tucker. I am a software engineer from Milliman Care Guidelines. I have a blog now because I used to post blog posts in the comments of other people's blogs, and Jeremy Miller got hella pissed at me one day. So I have my own blog, the Agileology blog. I started my own religion for Agile. Why? Because I can. I don't need a reason. So, yeah, I'm Jeff, and now back to you.
This is Brian Prince. I work for Microsoft now as well. I'm an architect evangelist, and I used to be a consultant for many, many years, and... been doing a lot of talking recently about interviewing and career skills and soft skills and so on. So if you're in the Heartland District, Ohio and so, you should drop by Central Ohio Day of .NET, Cleveland Day of .NET, Western Michigan Day of .NET, and so on.
My name is Aaron Jensen. I'm one of the Elution guys, quote unquote, and that's about it.
My name is Owen Aney. I'm also known as Ian Drain, and... I'm responsible for the RhinoMox project. I'm a member of a few other open source projects, such as Inhibernate or Castle, and that's about it.
My name is Aaron Erickson. I work for a company called Magenic. We like to do stuff that's not in vogue these days, stuff that's not TDD, but we'll live with it. But we have a good time, and I'm happy to be here with all these great guys, and we're having a good time. So,
awesome. All right, so who's got the first story to tell about an interview? Brian Prince raised his hand, so we're going to go to Brian, and then we're going to come back to Mr. Magentic here, who's got the next story. All right, Brian, so tell us about your story.
Well, I don't know if I have a war story about interviewing. I would say that when you are interviewing, look for companies that are trying to get to know you versus trying to fill a seat. And you can tell that by how they interview you. If it's just an SAT-style interview, asking you 9,000 questions that you could look up in MSDN or Google, and if that's the only real important part of the interviewing system, it's probably not a great company for you.
Okay, so you said SAT, so you meant by just question.
Four pillars of OOP, things that you can Google easily.
Functions, procedures, voids, and properties. I think that's right.
No, you didn't get any one of them right.
Oh, sorry about that.
Rejected.
Now, that type of technical interview is important in the interviewing process, but it should probably only be 20% of the weight. You want to find out what they're passionate about. Do they have passion? Do they know how to learn? Do they know how to solve problems? That's what an employer should be looking for. And try to get to know who you are.
Okay, so how do you measure passion? I had a blog article
about
this.
I know, and yeah. I disagree with you on this. It doesn't matter what they're passionate about, but you ask them. Like, so I've interviewed people and said, you want to be a dev lead on my team, and that's really cool. So what do you do when you get home at night? And they're like, oh, I don't use computers at home because I'm on them all day, and God, I'm so burned out. That's a big sign. But if they go off on 20 minutes about what version of the Linux kernel they've compiled yesterday, or how many different servers they have, then that's a good sign. And then also, if they have read about, I know we're not supposed to talk about things that aren't out yet, but if they are reading about things that aren't out yet, that aren't necessarily part of their day job, then that shows some passion. If they go to user group meetings, most of my team came from people who go to user group and code camps.
Okay. Somebody just said, what about Warcraft? So...
Yeah, passion is passion. I don't care what it's about, but you can channel that. If it's about technology, if you channel that through your work.
Okay, now, You look like you're just really itching to say something. So
the way I always said it is that...
Say your name again.
My name's Jeff again. Okay. The way I always say it is I code 10 hours a day pretty much no matter what. I happen to get paid for the first date. That's awesome.
Oren is laughing.
Yes, Oren is laughing.
He's over here beside
right
himself
now.
I mean, he's.
Is he?
I mean, Oren's laughing.
I know.
He only codes 10 hours.
Code 10 hours a day. I don't blog like 12 hours a day. Code 14 hours a day. I actually witnessed Oren. I witnessed him patch something and blog about it during one session at DevTeach. I saw this occur. I interviewed somebody a while ago. Typically, the way I do an interview is I will ask somebody some basic questions about stuff they have on their resume. Basic sniff test, are they just totally full of crap, or do they actually know what they're talking about? And then after that, I'll give them a simple programming problem, something that I would expect anybody to be able to solve in less than 20 minutes. Typically, these are problems that I can solve in less than 1 minute. So this question I asked this person is, I want you to write me a function that takes one integer n as an input and prints every prime number between 0 and n to the screen. And assume that there's a function called print that prints to the screen. I'm not worried about screen, you know, I/O, any of that crap. I'm more interested in their thought process, right? So they tell me they don't really understand the problem. Okay, I'll re-explain it. I will explain it as many times as I have to. Not a problem. I re-explain what I want. And they told me again that they think for a minute and they said, wait a minute. What exactly is a primary number again? Yeah, that was when I realized probably this person would not be a good fit for this particular organization.
Did you at least ask them and like to add numbers and subtract numbers? Or
you can't stop the interview right there. I mean, first of all, everybody's always going to need some amount of coaching on an interview. I had somebody one time who totally misinterpreted a question. Took me 5 minutes to communicate with them successfully, but after a while, they were able to write a good algorithm. Still didn't hire them, but they were great. But we, you know, I explained to her what a prime number is. I'm like, you know, maybe she didn't know. And I went ahead and explained it to her, and of course, she still wasn't able to write even half a line of code that made any sense. So, yeah, not a good interview. Not good.
Not a good one. All right, so next we got Aaron from Agentic.
I will say, there's a company called Bear Stearns. Everybody heard of that?
Bear Stearns?
Bearing
Stearns?
Bear Stearns.
Bear Stearns.
Yes.
Hang on, Jeff's got a
They asked me, Bear Stearns.
Didn't they just implode or something?
Yes,
didn't
they
did. Their share price went from $60 a share to like $5 a share, and then I shorted them. And then
that's why you're rich. You're rich because of Bear Stearns. But this is what happened. They asked me what the using statement did about a year ago before I was an MVP. I didn't have the right answer because I didn't know what it did. And I'm a C-sharp MVP now. The using statement is almost kind of obsolete. You know, you shouldn't have to worry about whether something's going to be disposed or not. That should be taken care of automatically. Oren.
And I completely disagree with that because you have two things here. One, you have perform disposal of something. Dispose this connection to the database. Dispose this handle to the file. Dispose some memory that I'm holding or stuff like that. Things like that, you can handle that with the GC. And if you're looking at what the Java guys are doing, a lot of the time they are letting the GC handle that. But for a wide variety of other problems, you want to have this context because you want to have, in this context of the using statement, I know that I'm unsure of two things. If the initialization succeeds, if the initialization is successful, the dispose will be called. And that allows me to make guarantees about how I'm handling things. From anything from how to handle locking, so I can dispose the lock on the user dispose, to having very easy way to have semantics of a piece of code. In this piece of code, I'm inside a transaction. In this piece of code, I'm I'm outputting all the text to the console using the green color. And when I'm exiting this piece of code, I will revert to the previous version. And this has nothing to do at all with disposal of resources.
Well, and I don't disagree with you. In fact, what you're talking about is absolutely necessary stuff that happens. It was a minor point. You know, the point was that somebody, you could have explained that to me in 5 minutes, I would have understood it. And they, you know, disqualified me from a consulting gig because I didn't happened to run into that nuance before somebody explained it to me.
I don't agree that it's a nuance. I think that this is one of the core concepts of the way that you work with C#. And I think that not knowing that is a problem, but it's not an insurmountable problem. It's certainly something that you can learn very easily. But here, let me give a horror story from an interview that I did. About a year and a half ago, my company started doing headhunting. And for some reason, I was picked as the interviewer for the technical part. One of the interviews for a junior position come in, and he has a two-year experience in C# and ASP.NET. And I think that I just read about the FISBAS test, which basically says give the developer a trivial assignment just to show that he can code. And the assignment that I gave this person was given the string 1, 2, 3, 4, output the string 4, 4, 3, 2, 1. Can you estimate how long this should take? There is no string reverse in C#. So, yes.
You have to write it, yeah.
So what
Aaron is saying is that
you can write it pretty quickly if you know the algorithm.
Oh, yeah,
string
absolutely.
Reversal, not a complicated algorithm. I mean, it's
the reversing a string or reversing an array is very simple. So I give this assignment to this person, and I'm not asking him to write it on a paper or write it on a whiteboard. I'm handing him, here's my laptop, here's Visual Studio with an empty project, just write the code. And I'm looking at him, and he's asking questions about how do I do that, and I'm answering this question, and it's starting to get very suspicious. And it's after 10 minutes pass, I'm at the point of, okay, I'm never going to hire this person, but let us see how far we can make this happen. Please stop. Go to Google. I want you to see how we solve this problem with Google. So we go to Google, did a search for string reverse in C#. Now, the third result at the time was StarRev, the standard C implementation. The fourth result was reversing a string in C#. The second result was reversing a string. He went to the third result, copy-pasted the entire method into Visual Studio, and spent another 15 minutes trying to make this compile.
Wow.
Yeah. So that is, you know that you stopped to look at the car crash? That was the feeling that I had at the time.
We just handed the mic to Brian. So, Brian, I mean, you've done a lot of interviews yourself. I mean, how do you judge that line of, I mean, we're talking about a using statement here.
Well, so I think in this particular instance, that's more of a trivia question. You know, if there was a core, what we used to have people come in and do auditions, and I want to see them, they would come into the whole team, and they would do kind of like a lunch and learn or a lightning talk or a grok talk on any subject they wanted. And we got to see them move around within Studio and write some code that they had written or walk through some code that they had written. And that, to me, is much more valuable because if they have a need to know how to dispose of some complicated object, then they can go figure out how to use using. Because I'm hiring someone who knows how to learn.
Right. So what you're saying is, like, if I did try catch finally, I mean, actually, I write try finally catch as a compile. But if you write try catch finally and you disposed of your stuff, you'd be happy. But if they didn't do that, that would be bad. But if they did the using statement, that would be better, shorter, quicker, faster. Okay, Aaron's got a thing.
Use the dispose method.
But what using gives you is ensure disposal. That's the main thing. Yeah, I know, but why? You know, if you do a try catch finally, I'm fine with that. I will give you that as a look. You're doing it this way. This is the right way to do that, okay? In a code review or something like that. But this
can
is not.
Can I give you a compliment?
Yeah.
The using method is better. When I learned using, I was like, "That's way better."
Yes.
I just hadn't been exposed to it yet.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And when I learned it, I'm like, oh, immediately it clicked, and I used it every single time I'd seen it since.
Absolutely.
I just hadn't seen it yet.
Yes, but
and there's a lot of people that are Morts, quote,
mm-hmm.
that do really good work that just haven't seen that pattern yet because they're not people that go to conferences. They're not people that go to user groups. They're not people that do the kinds of things that you and I do.
Don't you think that there is some sort of responsibility from the developer to know in what to know the environment, at least to some level?
I do now that I go to those environments.
No. I'm talking about the average developer. If I'm going to have a developer that I'm not having a big expectation from him,
sure.
But I want him to be able to solve a problem without, I don't know, writing reams of code or doing stupid stuff because he lacks basic understanding of the environment. It's a very simple example.
So let me ask you this, Oren. Okay. Yeah. So I wrote a try, catch, finally, and I disposed. I cleaned up. Am I bad?
Yes.
Am I horrible?
No.
I mean, am I a bad person because I didn't write a using statement?
Wait a minute. For the try, catch,
don't
finally.
Don't answer that question because I'm a bad person. But I
for
mean,
the try, catch, finally, I would say that this merits a note in the code review. Dude, you can do it easier.
So we're talking about easier. It's a shortcut.
It's a shortcut. It's
it
better.
Is a shortcut.
It's
and it really
more
is
readable.
A shortcut.
Yes.
It is.
Absolutely. But if I see you not disposing, or if I'm seeing, here is a good example. Okay? Try to imagine this in your head. I was called to assist a highly critical multi-threading issues. So before, usually when I'm coming to consult on such an issue, I'm doing a review session before I start. What application does? What is the problem? Why is the problem impossible to happen? So I'm sitting with them and I'm having issues with data corruption because of multi-threading access to the data, and they can't understand what is going on because we lock everything. And I'm saying, okay, they probably missed something, and there is a race condition, or there is some memory model issues that they haven't figured out or something like that. And I'm going to spend the next 2 weeks here trying to figure out what is going on. And then I'm going to look at their code. And their code is something like that. Lock, new object, do something. Okay? Imagine. Lock, open parenthesis, new object, close parenthesis. So that is obviously not going to lock anything because you always have a new implementation, a new object instance, and it will never lock. So that means that you don't have the basic understanding of what the hell you're doing. You are a cargo cult. You're familiar with this term? You're doing something because you heard this is good. You should use Ajax because this is a new thing. I'm writing for embedded devices that run my refrigerator. There is no Ajax involved. But it's a new thing. You should do that. Lacking this understanding is critical. You know what? Here's a good example. If you don't understand how I can do arbitrary locking on a piece of data without going to kernel level with kernel level handles, that's fine. You don't really need that. Because this is something that really requires you to do to have some deep understanding of how the locking works and how the CLR works. I don't care, but basic understanding should be there.
Okay, so to my left right now, we're going to pass the mic over to some guys over here that have been sitting patiently and quiet. Now, Rob, you work for Microsoft.
Yes, that is the reported position.
Tell us about the interview process at Microsoft. I mean, what did they ask you? How was it? Was it painful? Did it hurt? You know, I've heard a lot of war stories out there.
Yeah, no, it was not easy. It was. I came out of there convinced that they were going to say thank you and goodbye. It's actually a kind of progressive interview experience where you talk with a series of people, usually about five, and if you don't make the first pass at the interview, they'll send an email out to the rest of the group and say no hire or whatever. And I managed to make it through all five, so I thought, well, that's probably a good sign that I made it to the end of the interview process. But, yeah, it was not easy at all.
Did you ever have to touch a whiteboard during the interview?
Oh, sure. Oh, yes.
Sure?
Oh, yeah.
Write code on the whiteboard for
Express?
Yes.
Yes, yeah? Yes, I did.
Give us a story about that, then.
Well, so I sat in a room with Brad Abrams, and, you know, read his books, read his blog.
Right.
A personal hero of mine. He sat there, and he was a really good guy. And he's like, so, you know, he's got that kind of drawl. A little bit of does, Southern. Yeah. Like, North Carolina, right? Is that where he's from?
I'm not sure, actually, but he has a little bit of drawl. Yeah.
Whatever. It's from the South. Anyway, so, yeah, he looked at me, and he's like, so, and he asked me this question. And I was like, I'm talking to Brad Abrams. And he's like, and, you know, and he's like, so, blah, 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 and that's all I heard. And I said, what? And he's just looked at me. He said something about Fibonacci. And then I was like, okay, what? You know, and then he just, that was it. And I, so I started writing on a whiteboard, and evidently I didn't fail.
Basically, you BS'd your way through it then. I mean,
no. I'm not allowed to actually give up the interview questions because I'd be
That's perfectly fine. We understand that.
Hot water.
We understand that.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it was a very fun process, and I got to hang out with those guys. Yeah, it was kind of hard because I really respect those guys, and they would tell me the next person you're going to talk to is so-and-so, and I'd know who they were, and I was like, oh, great. You know, oh, great. And this person's going to ask me that. But they were really nice, and everything went off pretty well. Yeah.
Scott, over here to your left of you.
Yep.
Works for Telligent. You interview a lot then, probably, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so what's your first question you ask on an interview?
I don't even know if I have a first question anymore. My main philosophy is to have the people who are going to work with that person. But in a nutshell, I really rely on the people who are going to work with that developer, on their feedback. At the end, you know, myself or, you know, someone else, you know, always has the kind of go, no go. But, you know, we model a lot of the stuff we do after Microsoft. So we do the same, you know, kind of emails behind the scenes, you know, hire, no hire. Everyone has an explicit answer. There's no maybes. So if you're going to say, you know, so if we interviewed Rob and someone said maybe, a maybe is a no. And then, you know, we kind of move on from there. So
you don't do points. You just say,
yeah, just it's yes or no and kind of why.
Okay.
And so that way, you know, for the most part, I mean, if there's a no, then we move on. Every once in a while, there's a no, and it's no because, we're interviewing for a senior dev, and I don't think this person's a senior dev. I think they're a junior dev or in the middle. So every once in a while, there's a little bit where we can kind of teeter back and forth. But for the most
sort of like a 0-1. It's like, you know, on or off. But you have, you sort of have a 0.5 in there. I mean,
on extreme cases, but usually it's yes or no.
Yeah. Good.
So
how long do interviews take?
There's usually 4 to 5, like, 1 hour interviews. You know, so
there's looking, 4 to 5.
1 hour interviews. 1 hour interviews. A screening interview, you know, before then.
So. You bring them on site there and do all your stuff?
Depending on the team. Most of my team's remote, so, you know, so a lot of the interviews for my team are over the phone.
Okay. Thank you, Scott. Appreciate that. Steve, you recently joined Quick Solutions, didn't you?
I did.
Tell us about your interview process there.
Well, I had a kind of probably atypical interview process. Brian Prince, who used to run our whole division, I guess handpicked me maybe out of the community. I feel like maybe I kind of got the automatic pass, but I went through the tech interviews and all that. And there's a particular guy who does our tech interviews who's been known to make people cry.
Oh,
and
okay.
I didn't cry during mine, and I feel like maybe it was because Brian maybe kind of handpicked me, and I got the automatic thumbs up. But to be honest, I actually want to make someone cry someday if I can ever get to that level where I can give a tech interview and make someone cry.
Trust me, it's not fun.
No, I'm sure it's not fun, but I feel like it would make a great war story for just this type of interview.
Yeah.
So, for that alone, I would love to have that experience. But no, I had nothing but great interviews. I had Brian and Jim Holmes, both great MVPs, both just champions for the company. Came out to the community, realized that community is important, and I think that's one of the biggest things that brought me to that company is that they realized community is where it's at. You know, talent. Brings in talent, right? And
yeah.
Without that and without the support, you really got nothing. You're just another corporate entity with no face. So that's where it's at, and that's what brought me in there, and I hope that's what keeps bringing people in there.
Okay, so let's take a poll here. We got actually Scott Bellward join us. So, Scott.
Of course, be nice.
Be nice, Scott. Do you ever interview people?
Yes.
Yes?
For jobs?
Yeah.
Yes.
So what's one of your favorite questions to ask?
I don't ask questions. I do pair programming for interviews.
You do
4 hours of pair programming.
Okay, so tell us about that. Everybody's clapping here.
There is applause from the crowd.
There's applause from the crowd. And the so tell us about that.
So interview questions are relevant. If you're asking, most of the people who ask interview questions are asking questions to show the people they're interviewing what they know.
Okay.
Right? So what I want to do with an interview, I ask them for codes. I ask them for the resume. I ask them for the resume. I look at the resume. If I want to know more, I ask them for a code sample with unit tests that run inside Visual Studio. No end-to-end test. They got to run. It's got to compile and run. If that works, I ask them to come in for 4 hours of pair programming. And all the questions in the world that I would want to ask them that I know I want to show off, I want to, as an interview, I want to show off what I know.
Okay.
I want to avoid doing that.
Okay.
Because that's a self-indulgence and identification.
Go back, Scott, and explain the pair. Because not everybody's going to be familiar with pair programming, so explain that concept, though.
We create a context within which we can explore problem space and then potential solution spaces through test-driven development.
Give an example of that. Got an analogy?
I start with a user story.
Okay.
As a customer relationship manager, I want to provide discounts to customers who are repeat business, something like that. And then I provide a bunch of acceptance criteria. And then when I say, how do we solve this? And inevitably, if they're from Microsoft, they say, well, let's draw a model. And I say, no, let's write a test. And then we write tests. And then we work through test-driven development. And through test-driven development, we work through all kinds of things like friction and dependency injection and separation of concerns, Demeter principle, Liskov substitution. We work through all the fundamentals. And it doesn't matter that they don't know these things going in. It matters that when we bring them up, that they start to get it. And if they can start to get it, then I can start to understand that they're relevant people to hire.
Okay, so Orange got the mic now.
Okay, how many people are you going to interview for a certain position? And how much time are you going to spend on each interviewee at each cycle? Because 42. Wait,
and somebody said 42. So.
This is important. What I'm talking about is very simple. I want to be able to get good people, but when I'm asking for good people, I have two ways to do that. One, I know of someone and I'm going to get him. Okay, and in this case, the max that I would do is maybe do some validation check with someone else that can verify that this person is a good fit for the position that we are taking of offering him. The second part is actually having to do is actually getting some leads from a headhunter or a recruiting company or putting an ad in the newspaper, in which case I'm going to get usually a lot of candidates. Most of them sucks. Okay? This sucks. Yes.
They suck so bad that they suck in plural. They sucks. I agree with Oren. They suck.
I have a very legitimate question. So, Scott and Oren, let me just ask you. What makes a qualified candidate for one of you guys to hire?
Somebody that I've known for years. Somebody that can prove that they can do the work.
Well, okay, so... Maybe that's it, that you can prove you learn. But, Scott, I mean, a lot of times you don't know someone for a lot of years, right? But what is it that, Oren, that says to you, hey, this guy or girl, whatever, that they can be a valuable part of your team? What is that quality?
Let me give you an example. I tend to have levels in interviews. The first level is just my goal in the first level of interviews. I want to rule out as many people as possible, because any minute that I'm spending in interviewing the guy that can't try a string reverse algorithm, it's stupid to call it an algorithm, but every minute that I have to spend on this kind of guy is a waste of my time and a waste of the company time and a waste of everyone's time. And probably waste of his time as well. Okay? I want to make this as short as possible. Once he passed that stage, that I think he's acceptable. I don't think he's acceptable. I don't think he's unacceptable. Okay? Then I can start doing a lot more work to see if he's a really good fit. And it's a good example. In most scenarios, if I see any mention of open source work in his resume, I'm going to skip two or three layers in this ladder, and because I'm already assuming.
If you have a code example that you can go after, you can go look and see what he's done, right?
I have that, but I have something much more than that. I have a tangible proof that this guy has interest in programming beyond just drag this table to the form.
Right.
And he has
passion.
He has passion. He cares enough about that, so he wants to make this public. So that's a very good indication from the start. If he says that he does pet project, it's not open source, that's also a good idea. Because I don't care about the openness of the code. I just care that he's doing things. Yes, he has the passion to do it.
One of the things I say is it's not about what you write, okay? I've written a lot of code in my life. I've PKs up for Windows, you know, a lot
assuming
of things.
Assuming you're a developer, you should write a lot of code in your life.
Yeah, I've written a ton of code. But, exactly. This is the thing I want from the community. You know, if I say anything to anybody here, and I've thought about this for a long time, it's not just what you do in our open source frameworks and the things we do, but what have we done for our company? Have we saved $25 million for a pharmaceutical company that wants to save money by saving money in their supply chain? What have we done? What's the business value of Mox, okay? Can we connect what we've done in an open source project to real money a company has saved, to real outcomes that have occurred?
This is Jeff again. Actually, I was able to do that at my last company. One of the things that I like to do was actually calculate dollar values and how much money I saved, which is not exactly an easy thing to do, but it is possible. And that's one thing, you know, if you can say, I saved my company 92 man hours per week by developing this process and doing that, you know, that's great. You know, not a lot of people can say that, but, you know, really that's one of the things that I really look for in somebody is, you know, not what did you do there? I wrote web applications in C#. Well, great. You were a software developer. I know that. I can read your job title. It tells me what you did. But what did you actually do? Did you save them time? Did you save money? Did you save resources? Did you enable the same resources to do more work in less time? You know, those are the kinds of things that are really, really important. And those are things that I look for.
I ask a Southern question, sort of. It's a very open-ended question. It's not a yes or no. It's not a, you know, analyze this. It's not a whatever. I want to see if the person can think. So one of the questions I do is the chicken question. What? Chicken question. Or a duck question or whatever. So the question is, and it's I didn't create this. I just found it and identified with it because I used to raise chickens. So, and it says basically, pretend that you your boss just bought a business and you now own a chicken farm, or you're a software developer for a chicken farm. You need to write the business object for the chicken farm. What the whole question is about is to understand object-oriented programming concepts to see if the person will focus on the business requirements for the chicken farm. How do you solve the problem where some chickens lay eggs and some don't? And if you don't know about chickens, female chickens lay eggs, and roosters are the male, yeah, and they don't lay eggs.
That is familiar sort of like, from other
yes,
species.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. Okay.
How would you
solve that business problem? That
if you're going to have public class chicken, public class rooster inherit from chicken, a public class hen inherit from chicken, that's a problem in your domain.
What if I had abstract bird, and then I had
no, you have to have abstract animal. And abstract
well,
animal,
if you want
to
go back even further, yeah.
From I object.
Okay, abstract bird, you only have chickens in your chicken farm, so Yagni principle. What other birds do you have? You have chickens. You're not going to need other birds. Thank you.
There you go.
You have mices as well.
Well, so you have some chickens that can lay eggs. Maybe you have other birds that can't lay eggs. So what I would do is I would invoke a strategy pattern using iEggable or something like that. If something can lay eggs, it implements the interface iEggable. And it has something called like lay egg or something like that. And that would take care of it. That would solve the problem.
I don't. I by the way.
Exactly. iEggable. This is Jeff Tucker, the Agile Fog, iEggable. look for it in the near future.
Okay. Abel, da, Abel pattern, naming pattern, is really, really bad. What I use is I can lay eggs, which is much better.
To hell with I can lay eggs. I eggable. It's all about I eggable.
I like his better. I can lay eggs because that's what I can lay eggs.
It's exact. It's what you want to do. And you know what? You can write some BDD specifications around that. You know why? Because you're laying exactly what you want to do.
Okay, just because you can lay eggs doesn't mean you're going to lay eggs. So I can lay eggs? That's great. What if you have a chicken that doesn't feel like laying eggs? What if it gets pissed off at you and doesn't say, you know, I'm not going to lay eggs for you anymore because I want retirement benefits? Maybe your chicken says that. How is your design going to handle that?
It's very easy. It's I can lay egg has an event. Won't lay eggs. The event handler for won't lay eggs... does something like that.
Orin is already on event handlers,
man. Transform
chicken
to steak. Very simple. I solve you this problem.
So how exactly would you implement the event handler, you know, the whole lay eggs thing? So what if something's not capable of laying eggs like a rooster? I mean, you're going to have a delegate with like some sort of no? Well, we just talked about that. Hold on a second. Let me give the microphone over to Orin again.
How would I handle the rooster? The rooster wouldn't have... wouldn't be able to lay eggs, so it wouldn't have I can lay eggs.
Okay, this reminds me of a funny joke. So a guy walks into a bar.
Wait. If the rooster lay an egg, that is an exception. Okay? And rooster laid egg exception is unhandled and will cause the system to crash. That is by design.
Wait, is it an exception or an error code? Because I could argue that it could be an exception, but I could also say it's an error code because roosters might not be able to lay eggs.
Or just be a regular exception?
This is an unhandled exception,
that
inherits from Dreadabout exception, so it will kill the system. There are something that you are not meant to do.
Okay, well, we passed the point of return. I don't know if this is going to make the air or not, but I want to thank everybody that was at the roundtable tonight here at the MVP Summit. Everybody did a great job. We had a lot of good back and forth. Appreciate everybody again.
Thank you.
Rob Connery, Steve, Scott, appreciate everybody. And this is it. Deep Fried Bites out. We'll see you.